Welcome back to the deep dive. You know, when you think about the human body, it's just incredible, especially the digestive system. It's this huge, like 25-foot network.
Absolutely, full of specialized bits, acid factories, muscular gates.
And the really wild part, it all starts as just a simple straight tube in the embryo.
It is probably the most dramatic transformation in our anatomy. We're digging into our source materials today, mostly developmental textbooks, trying to, pull back the curtain on how that simple cylinder becomes the gut we know.
Yeah, and our mission today is to pull out three key things for you. First up, the molecular border patrol, how organs define themselves so sharply. Then we'll get into the, frankly, bizarre physical journey the gut takes rotation and even getting evicted for a bit.
That temporary hernia, it's fascinating.
And finally, how specific genetic codes create specialized regions and even influence nearby organs, like the spleen, which is a bit of a mystery itself.
Okay, let's dive in. Starting with those boundaries. The stomach, right? It's not just a sack. Think of it more like a high-security chemical plant. Needs serious containment.
Right. And the books say the border between this stomach factory and the next section, the small intestine, it isn't gradual at all. It's like a cliff edge, molecularly speaking.
That's exactly it. It's all down to these master genetic switches.
Yeah.
On the stomach side, you've got a transcription factor called SOX2 running the show.
SOX2, okay.
But the very instant SOX2 expression stops, bang, the intestinal identity kicks in, defined by CDX2.
So they can't coexist.
Not at all. It's a complete zero-sum game, one or the other. And that sharp line dictates the entire boundary. It's incredibly precise.
Wow. Okay, so that's the molecular border secured. Then the stomach lining itself, the gastric mucosa, starts building its toolkit. What kind of specialized cells pop up?
Well, you get the main workers for the factory floor. Progenitor cells differentiate into five main types. Mucus cells to protect the lining.
Makes sense. Acid protection.
Exactly. Then chief cells making enzymes, parietal cells, those are the acid pumps.
the crucial ones.
Definitely. And also endocrine cells for signaling and these interesting tough cells, probably for sensing things in the stomach contents. And crucially, there's a pool of stem cells kept aside near the gland openings
For repairs.
for continuous turnover. Means the lining can regenerate throughout life. It's built for the long haul.
So it's constantly refreshing. We mentioned the acid pumps. When does the factory actually switch on the acid production?
That's a key milestone. It happens just before birth. Those parietal cells start churning out hydrochloric acid, HCl.
So it's ready to go from the first meal.
Pretty much immediately, yeah.
Okay, but if you've got acid, you need control, right?
Yeah.
Valve. The pyloric sphincter.
Yeah.
How does the body build that muscular gate right at that precise molecular border we talked about?
The pyloric gate. Its formation needs another specific set of instructions. Transcription factors like SOX9 and ANGPTX2.5 are key players here, and they get activated by signals like one called BMP4. What's really neat is that the genetic toolkit used here involving multiple Hox genes isn't just for this one sphincter.
Oh, it's used elsewhere.
Yeah, the same kind of Hox gene logic helps specify all three major digestive checkpoints: the pyloric one, the ileocecal valve between the small and large intestine, and the anal sphincter. It's like a repeating module in the genetic blueprint for building sphincters.
That's efficient design.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've got the tube, the boundary, the gate. Now, the big problem, space. How does this initially straight tube become that huge coiled mass inside us? This is the great intestinal migration you mentioned.
It really is an epic journey. Elongation, rotation, relocation.
Yeah.
It's all driven by the gut tube growing much, much faster than the embryo itself.
Right.
To picture it, you need a couple of landmarks. There's the point where the midsection of the gut connects to the yolk stalk.
Okay, the nutrient
connector. And the other is the superior mesenteric artery, the SMA. That artery is critical. It acts like a fixed pivot point for the whole twisting process later on.
And this growth is just explosive, isn't it? How does it accelerate so fast?
It's mainly down to the mesenchymal cells, so the sort of connective tissue cells within the gut wall just proliferating like crazy.
Any specific signals driving that?
The research points to signals like 1,5-A, that's Sonic Hedgehog, and FGFs. They really push that growth. So much so that by about 5 weeks, the tube has grown so long it has to buckle outwards, forming a kind of hairpin loop.
A hairpin loop, and that leads to the twist, right? The big counterclockwise rotation that sets up the whole layout of our abdomen. What actually generates the force for that twist?
It's fascinating. The main driver seems to be uneven growth and changes within the dorsal mesentery, that's the sheet of tissue anchoring the gut. And it's orchestrated by a molecule called PDX2.
Bidex2, I've heard of that. Isn't it involved in left-right body asymmetry generally?
Exactly. It's the master controller for left versus right. Here in the gut mesentery, PDX2 causes the mesenchymal cells on the left side to behave differently. They get more condensed, the epithelium changes shape.
While the right side doesn't.
Precisely. This difference creates a sort of internal tension, a buckling force that initiates the rotation.
Wow, so tiny cellular differences create this massive anatomical twist. How much does it turn initially?
It starts with about a 90-degree counterclockwise turn, and that's vital. It swings the part that will become the large intestine across the front of the small intestine.
Ah, setting up that C-shape for the colon.
Exactly. It allows the colon to eventually settle along the walls of the abdominal cavity in its familiar position. Without PIX2 doing its job properly, the whole gut layout can be completely messed up.
Okay, but the growth is still happening, right? Even after the twist starts. And the embryo's body cavity is still tiny. Where does it all go?
Well, it runs out of room. Simple as that. Which leads to what the textbooks call the physiological or obligatory umbilical hernia.
Obligatory hernia. So the intestines basically get evicted.
Temporarily, yes. It's a necessary step. Around week 6 or 7, the sheer volume of the rapidly elongating intestinal loops is just too much for the small abdominal cavity.
So where do they go?
They herniate out into the base of the body stalk, essentially, into the umbilical cord.
They live in the umbilical cord.
For how long?
For several weeks, yeah. It's like temporary housing while the main apartment, the abdominal cavity, gets bigger.
Talk about extreme measures. What tells them it's okay to move back in?
By about week 9 or 10, the abdominal cavity is finally expanded enough, and then there's this really coordinated return sequence. The small intestine loops go back first.
Okay.
As they re-enter, they kind of push the end parts of the colon, the bits that stayed inside, over to the left side. That establishes the position of the descending colon.
Got it.
Then the first part of the colon, the cecum and ascending colon, returns last. It swings across down towards the lower right side, and that final move locks in the typical adult arrangement. It's like a carefully choreographed dance.
That is just mind-bending spatial coordination. Okay, let's shift gears slightly. We followed the main tube, but other organs are developing right alongside it. What about the spleen? You mentioned it was enigmatic. It really is. Developmentally, its origins are often described as not well understood, which is textbook code for it's complicated and we don't know everything.
Huh, right. Where does it come from?
It starts around week 4. It appears as just a thickening, a condensation of mesenchymal cells in that dorsal mesentery tissue right behind the developing stomach. And it's very closely linked physically to the developing pancreas initially.
So it's born right there in the gut's neighborhood, even though its main job later is immune function, not digestion. What are the molecular signals that kickstart spleen development?
The initiation seems to need a team effort from factors like POD1 and BAPX1. They work together, apparently through another factor called PBX1, to turn on key downstream genes like MAX2.5 and especially HOX11.
Hox genes again? Seems they pop up everywhere in development.
They're fundamental for regional identity. And an interesting thing about the spleen's early function for a few months during pregnancy, from about month 3 to 5, the spleen is actually a major site of hematopoiesis.
Making blood cells. Like the bone marrow does later.
Exactly. The liver does this too, early on. The spleen helps make blood cells before the bone marrow takes over that job permanently. Shows how functions can shift during development.
That really highlights specialization. And that specialization happens within the gut tube itself, too, right? It's not just one long intestine. It needs specific sections like the duodenum, jejunum, ileum. How are those regions genetically defined?
Yeah, you need different tools for different jobs along the line. Think of it like coding different functional zones. The very first part of the small intestine, the upper duodenum, which gets all that stomach acid and needs to start serious digestion, is heavily influenced by a gene called PDX1.
PDS1, okay.
Then, as you move further down into the lower duodenum and the jejunum, another factor, GATA4, becomes prominent.
Defining that middle section.
Right. And then for the final stretch, the ileum, which has different absorption tasks, it's mainly GATA6 that sets the regional identity. This ensures the cells in the ileum are equipped differently, say, for absorbing vitamin B12 compared to cells higher up.
So it's like a genetic address system for each segment. What about the cecum, that little pouch where the small and large intestines meet? How does that form?
The cecum starts developing around week 6. Its formation is a great example of tissue layers talking to each other. It depends on signals passed between the inner lining, the epithelium, which produces FGF9, and the outer layer, the mesoderm, which responds with FGF10.
A molecular conversation.
Exactly. And this conversation is itself regulated by those broader regional identity genes like CDX2 and the MOX genes. For instance, studies in mice show if you knock out certain HOX genes, like HOXB0 through 13, that whole cecal region can just fail to develop. It shows how layered the control is.
Okay, this incredible precision is amazing. Let's bring it back to the real world for the listener. We see how complex and precise this development is. What happens clinically when these controls, either the molecular borders or the physical movements, go wrong?
Well, one relatively common issue relates back to that pyloric gate we discussed. It's called pyloric stenosis.
Stenosis, narrowing.
Exactly. The circular muscle layer of the pyloric sphincter gets way too thick at hypertrophies. This physically squeezes the exit from the stomach almost shut.
And the result must be pretty obvious.
Extremely. The main symptom is forceful projectile vomiting in infants, usually starting a few weeks after birth, because milk just can't get through properly. It's much more common in boys, suggesting a genetic link. But honestly, the exact reason why that muscle overgrows, it's still not fully understood. Frustratingly so.
And what about that sharp molecular border? SOX2 stopping, CDX2 starting. If that border control fails.
Yeah, that can lead to something called heterotopic gastric mucosa.
Heterotopic, meaning in the wrong place.
Precisely. You find patches of stomach lining actual gastric tissue in places it absolutely shouldn't be, like the esophagus or way down in the small intestine, maybe in a little outpocketing called a Meckel's diverticulum.
Why is that a problem?
Because if that misplaced stomach tissue still functions like stomach tissue,
it makes acid.
Exactly. If it retains the ability to secrete hydrochloric acid, it can cause painful ulcers and bleeding in that location because the surrounding tissue isn't designed to handle that acid.
Wow. That perfectly shows why getting those gene expression boundaries right is so critical.
Yep.
A misplaced molecular switch, you've got an aphid factory causing damage elsewhere.
It underlines it perfectly. And just quickly, other things can go wrong higher up in the esophagus. You can get stenosis there too, a narrowing, or even atresia where the tube doesn't form a proper opening at all.
And that has consequences even before birth.
Often, yes.
Great.
If the fetus can't swallow amniotic fluid because of the esophageal blockage, the fluid builds up excessively in the womb. That condition is called polyhydramnios.
Right. And finally, what about the spleen, that enigmatic neighbor?
Yeah.
Any common developmental issues there?
With the spleen, the anomalies tend to be more about its overall anatomy. You can have asplenia, where the spleen is completely missing.
No spleen at all.
Correct. Or the opposite, polysplenia, where instead of one spleen, you get multiple small accessory spleens, sometimes up to 16 little pieces.
16.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And importantly, these spleen anomalies are often found alongside other developmental problems, particularly heart defects or other gut malformations, which really points back to those shared developmental pathways and signaling in that region.
Okay. So wrapping this up, let's crystallize the most mind-blowing takeaways. For me, it's that incredibly sharp, zero-tolerance molecular border between stomach and intestine, yeah, defined by SOX2 versus CDX2. It's off and on.
That's a big one. And I think the role of PIDX2 in physically twisting the gut tube through differential growth on the left side of the mesentery, realizing that our fundamental body plan depends on these kinds of mechanical forces generated at the cellular level, that's pretty profound.
Definitely. And just the sheer logistical nightmare of the gut growing so fast, it has to literally move out into the umbilical cord for a while.
Oh.
That temporary hernia is just wild.
It's an absolute necessity, driven by pure spatial constraints. It really highlights the dynamics involved.
And underpinning all of this is that incredibly specific genetic code PDX1 saying build duodenum here, GATA6 saying build ileum here.
Exactly. It's a complex symphony of genetic instructions. Yet, as we touched on with pyloric stenosis and the heterotopic tissue, there are still gaps in our understanding. Clinical mysteries persist.
Which brings us perfectly to our final thought to leave you with. We see this intricate genetic control network, but we still don't fully grasp why sometimes the pyloric muscle just overgrows or what specific glitch causes a patch of stomach lining to set up shop in the wrong place and start pumping out acid.
Right. The root cause of that heterotopic gastric mucosa remains elusive.
So the provocative question is, given these remaining mysteries, what deeper, maybe more subtle layers of genetic or epigenetic control governing how our gut develops are still out there waiting to be discovered? It makes you wonder what else we're missing in that complex developmental blueprint.
A great question. There's clearly more to uncover.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the gut's incredible journey from simple tube to complex system. We'll catch you on the next one.